everyone. My name is Allison, and I am the McGill International Review's Editor-in-Chief.
My name is Theodora, and I am the MIR's Managing Editor. And welcome to the Editor's Desk.
This is MIR's podcast series, where we invite our editorial team to bring kitchen table conversations and current hot topics to the Editor's Desk. Today's episode is a deep dive into the social media trends of coquettiness, girlhood, and all the other things related. We're going to talk about over-consumerism, the Stanley Cup, intergenerational issues, as well as what it means to be a girl in today's age. Today we have staff writer Charlotte and senior editor Claire to talk to us about coquette. So why don't we start off with what comes to mind with the term coquette, what we think it is, and who is participating in it.
Well, when I think about coquette, I think about pink bows. I think about reclaiming girlhood and romanticizing like a Lana Del Rey, like Lolita-esque like story in your life.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, those ideas of like pink and bows, I think it's also bleeding into fashion and the way that people are kind of using it as a trend recently. And that goes for like younger girls, people that are like kind of teenage age, and even people who are like young adults. So I think it's kind of happening like simultaneously in different age groups.
Would you guys describe this as like a recent phenomenon or?
I would say so, yes, at least in like the past year or so, but I think definitely a lot more prevalent in the past like 3 to 4 months.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of like a pendulum swing like away from like the girl boss kind of era and into more of like pink, you know, hyper femininity type situation.
Yeah, I think also with pink and what it represents has a lot to do with girlhood and innocence. So as opposed to what you sort of mentioned with girl bossery, which is associated with maybe red or hot pink or this sort of corporate woman, the coquette trends that are coming out today have a lot more to do with preserving girlhood, preserving femininity, and sort of a return to traditional values, which I think is interesting. It comes also, I think, out of this timeline of post-COVID sort of cottage core aesthetics, wanting to return to, I don't know, the olden days where we just didn't have to worry about all these things. I think something that comes to mind also is just the, I'm just a girl, you know, all of those sort of flippant phrases that have bled into the vernacular recently that I think are representative of a greater movement, maybe away from girl bossery and towards being just a girl.
Mm-hmm. I've also noticed it a lot when it comes to kind of like sports and trends, where I think there's like a resurgence of like ballet as like an actual sport, but also just like as an aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And even like Pilates and these more like soft, feminine leading kind of like activities, which I feel like before it's more like girls can lift, like girls can do like kind mm-hmm. of like aggressive team sports. Like I feel like that was a little bit of like a kind of like a wave I was seeing in social media a while ago, but now it's like completely flipped in terms of like really soft, like, I don't know, more like delicate aesthetic, I guess.
I definitely agree. I think also with that, it reminds me a bit of the, with delicate and innocence, I think it's really hard for me to not associate it with bimbo-ness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it does make me think of Paris Hilton or yes. the early 2000s. And like with that, again, with trends like this, I think because they're so tied to fashion and aesthetics, also body types and mm-hmm. not wanting to be a gym girly who lifts, but being someone who goes to Pilates or bar classes and being more thin and toned as opposed to someone who's working out for the purpose of getting stronger or being healthier. Mm-hmm. I think all of that is sort of tied.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that like in terms of the bimbo-ness though, I don't necessarily think people are like bimbos in their like mindset about it though. Mm-hmm. Like I think that like this aesthetic is very, people are very hyper aware of like their presentation, and I think that like they are doing it very knowingly, whereas like, you know, maybe someone you would call a bimbo is kind of more ignorant.
When you're saying that they're doing it knowingly, do you think that this is more like a pushback against a girl boss, or is it just like another new dominant thing that just maybe not, like, is it defined in opposition, mm-hmm. do you think, to that? Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an attempt to respond to the girl bossery, but I think there are definitely some detriments to it that we'll get into. But just to add on to the bimbo comment from before, I do think it comes, I think it's done in a self-aware mm-hmm. way, where it's sort yeah. of like, I'm just a girl, I don't care about sports, or
mm-hmm. or like, I don't have to care.
Why is there this sudden resurgence of wanting to return to girlhood, especially among young women?
I mean, just first and foremost, I think there's always been such an obsession with looking and feeling young, especially when it comes to like women and youth. So maybe there are some, I don't know, there's a bit of like infantilization that I sense in this trend, and I feel like a lot of people might be not ready to accept that, but a lot of people are also participating in it in a way that's just really fun, and that doesn't seem like it's really deep, like it's just literally about looking cute and wearing pink. But I definitely think there's like more there.
When you say that's like looking young, I feel like traditionally that's not been like looking more childlike though. It's been more looking like someone in their 20s, but like now the aesthetic is clearly embracing certain more like infantilizing features. Mm-hmm. So where does that difference come from?
I mean, I think Claire, like you even brought up Lolita and like how we have this kind of like almost like a literary reference here.
Well, I think the thing is like a product of like, not to go back to everything tied to COVID, but I think people grew up, had to grow up really fast because of COVID and almost missed potentially childhood if you, you know, started COVID like when you were 10 years old, it ended when you were like 13, missing potentially a part of that, or even like for us, missing on key years of high school and then coming out of that wanting to go back and kind of go back to like that girlhood that we potentially missed. And I feel like the literary reference of Lolita has just been like a thing on social media that people relate it back to, like almost like if you have certain like icons that you can like relate to this trend, like Lolita would be one of them. Lana Del Rey is another one because of like her song lyrics are like very tied to almost like this return to girlhood sort of thing. But yeah.
I think also the nuance to it is almost that, yes, women have always wanted to look younger, but the childlike aspect is almost coming from this frustration with how much work there is to do, or like how much is expected of you as a woman. And so holding on to girlhood in that way and like innocence allows you to escape that set of responsibilities in a way. Whereas the Lolita aspect of it, I think also is interesting in that you want to hold on to girlhood for the freedom that it gives you relative to being a woman and the confines of what that means. But at the same time, a lot of the figures we have thinking about infantilizing women tends to also be tied to sexuality and hypersexualizing those figures. Mm-hmm. And so there's this like cognitive dissonance happening of this sexualized 20 something year old who has autonomy, agency, is, you know, the woman that we older women and young girls all want to be, that like mystique 20 year old something, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also this holding on to girlhood and innocence, I think, that the coquette trend is really representative of. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've talked about this more for, like, adult women, but what does this look like for younger girls? And is this the trend that's translating into a younger generation thing as well?
Yeah, I think for younger girls, I mean, it's really hard to navigate girlhood as it is, but I think the mystique of the 20-something-year-old is what I return to. So, younger girls, because of this lapse in, there's no tween, right? There's no awkward tween years or brands that are geared towards being a tween. Something that's so central to maybe Gen Z when we were in middle school ages is like Victoria's Secret lip balm, or going to Bath and Body Works and collecting those hand sanitizers. Like, you know, silly things like that that are marketed for the 12-year-old. I think 12, 11-year-olds, 10-year-olds even are going on TikTok and they're looking up to girls who are doing a full makeup get ready with me in college, and they're like, I want to go to Sephora and I want to buy all these different makeup products. And I think that trend is coming from social media, and that's why it might be a lasting one in terms of girlhood being collapsed in that way.
Yeah, I also think that the whole social media thing as well is like girls and their teens, tweens, whatever, can skip over that awkward phase. They have sort of older girls to look up to who, like, we went through that awkward middle school phase, the Victoria's Secret, like, perfume, whatever. And now on social media, people like us are showing what we're doing now. And so those girls can kind of skip over that. And I was actually reading this article from The Cut where it was interviewing, like, young girls, 10, 11, 12. And it was, there's one quote from this girl who was like, no one at recess wears jackets anymore. And it's just the drama of zipping up your jacket is crazy. But like, that's something that we would say, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's something where it's like we're prioritizing our own, like, fashion, especially, mm-hmm. like, to think about a 12-year-old not wearing a coat at recess because of the drama of the fashion of it all.
I feel like there's, like, a little parallel that popped up into my mind, and it's college girls not wearing coats when they go out to the bar, and they just drink, like, that's their coat for the night. And you have this, like, these literal, like, children almost, like, pulling from those ideas of, like, yeah, like, this is what it means to be cool at recess. And just as a side note, like, my mom is an elementary school teacher, and sometimes I pop into her class to, like, help with, like, a volleyball clinic, and it's crazy to see how young adult trends and, like, the clothing we wear and the makeup we use bleeds into, like, literal grade 6 and 7 classrooms, and I'm seeing, like, $250 super puffs and, like, Samba sneakers that were, like, a limited drop on, like, livestock or something, so it's actually insane.
I think also the last note I would add to that is this idea that things that I feel young women sort of feel tortured by, right? The idea of, like, your fashion aesthetic is just more important than function right now. Like, you're going to wear heels even though it's snowing outside. Those types of things that we associate, which are horrible, obviously, but we associate with this young woman sort of reaching womanhood. You know, you can't just be wearing sneakers anymore. Young girls at, like, 10, 11 years old are feeling that way. And, like, the age group of reaching the frustrations of being a woman are... you know, coming of age is happening so much younger.
Can you guys resolve, like, a conflict for me? This, because you guys are saying that, like, older people are trying to dress younger, mm-hmm. but you're saying that younger people dress older by imitating older people. Mm-hmm. So who's dressing like who here?
Well, I think that the younger people are dressing of what they think an older person would be like. And I think it's interesting because I'm reading, like, for example, about the 12-year-olds not wearing their coats at recess. I'm thinking to myself, like, what? Like, I want to wear my coat. Like, I totally, like, I think that that's almost, like, stupid in a way. Like, I feel like part of this whole thing about being a young girl is, like, that idea of, like, not caring about things. And, like, when you're a kid, at least we didn't care about things. Like, especially us growing up, we didn't necessarily have the same technology, social media, phones, whatever. And so it's almost like a desire to go back and not care. And, like, I think that is very, like, evident in the aesthetic and the attitude that we have in terms of going back to girlhood as well.
And I would almost argue that, though, that, like, we did care, but the things we cared about happened in such slower waves. So, like, sure, there was maybe, like, a Nike sneaker that everybody liked for, like, 6 to 8 months, and, like, you know, people who had maybe more money were able to buy them, but, you know, those trends would kind of come and go, and they weren't gonna be, like, they weren't going to affect who you were going to become friends with, like, at school, like, in your class. But now it seems that, like, every 4 to 6 weeks, there is something new that you either need to do or buy or look like. And I don't understand how people are keeping up. It seems, like, insane.
I think, yeah, to answer the conflict, it has a lot to do with what the opposite side is imagining the thing to be, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the imagination of girlhood versus what it actually was. Like, for example, I'm sure all of us, when we were in grade, like, 4 or 5, we were wearing maybe, like, Aviva or, like, you know, the baby brand, the tween brand of Lululemon, as opposed to the, and, like, what we're looking for when we're thinking about girlhood and the nostalgia for it is the simpler girl version of things, where we want, like, pink and bows, even though that's not necessarily what we were wearing, you know. But for the fifth grader now, there isn't an Aviva really anymore. You want, like, a Lululemon keychain for keys you don't have to your parents' home, right? Like, these are things that are influenced not by your peers, but by what you're seeing on social media. So another thing is, maybe it would dictate who you're friends with, because there are still cool girls, you know, in whatever age range or generation. But it would be the cool girls are wearing something that's cool for your age group, as opposed to now the cool girls are just acting way older. And so there's this constant trying to catch up to be, like, the mature girl of the group. And I think that's always been maybe a pattern for girls in girlhood, but it just looks so severely different now. A lot of my friends will say, I went home and saw my cousins, and I hadn't seen my cousin since COVID. So it was like they're 9 years old to 12 years old, and they look like they're 16. So there's the awkward stage of tweenager just doesn't happen anymore.
So would you say that the main driver of this is access to information through social media to how older people are dressing? That's what I'm saying. That's the sense that I'm getting from
you. I think on the younger end, it is totally coming from social media. I think from the older end, it's a romanticization of ideals that, you know, vary for people. But again, because of social media, there's this, like, way of boiling it all down to a couple of aesthetics, mm-hmm. and then everyone engages in it in this very simplistic way.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we can move on to what older women are doing, because we've talked maybe about college girls wanting to be coquette,
mm-hmm.
talked about tweens. But what about
millennials?
Millennials? Like, what are millennial women doing? They're leaving the girl bossery behind. What's going on?
Nara Smith, who we could characterize, she's a black woman married to Lucky Blue Smith, who is like a really famous, I don't know, like almost Tumblr era model.
Mm-hmm.
And they're Mormon, and they've definitely blown up on social media very recently, I would say. And she, basically her content is like home lifestyle content, specifically a lot of cooking. And it's very, I would describe it as very cottagecore, coquette, you know, kind, nurturing woman at home, like slaving away in the kitchen for 3 hours to make her kids like some sourdough in the morning. But it's very beautiful and soothing content, I will say for myself. I love consuming it because there's something about it that's just so, I don't know, it's almost like a dream-like facade, I will say.
I think there's like kind of two sides to like millennials like that. I think there is an audience for that that really does internalize the values that she's putting out there. And I think that that's like possibly where this younger group is getting it from, maybe potentially more like malleable to this sort of stuff. But I think that if you look in her comments as well, everyone's like, this is crazy, like, you're, you know, like, laughing at, like, her kids' names and stuff like that just because it's so out there. So I think there's kind of, like, two sides to that, but...
I was going to say a quick note on the coquette, like, cottagecore stuff, but
mm-hmm.
it's just so unrealistic, right?
Yes,
I think that's
yeah.
a lot of it. So people consume it even though they know it's completely unattainable because it's the soothing content of a world that almost could have been, even though if you actually think about that world, it was, like, the 1950s imagined housewife who obviously wasn't having fun. But because it's on social media and Nara Smith is this like, well, she's a model,
yeah,
she's beautiful,
mm-hmm.
she's always dressed to the nines in the kitchen. It doesn't actually make any sense, but she's like, my kids want a PB&J today, so I'm going to start making my bread and jam from scratch. Like, this is completely unattainable, right? But you
mm-hmm.
love consuming that content. And I think the interesting aspect of this as well is Nara Smith as a black creator is really the only one pushing that norm, because within TikTok, there's always been like the Mormon family, like the kind of wife who stays at home, who's making sourdough, like slaving away in the kitchen, but they've always been white or they live literally in Utah, you know? But for Nara Smith, it's sort of this, it sticks out, I would say,
yeah.
as sort of the one incredibly privileged
mm-hmm.
black woman who is accessing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely asks, it means we need to have a conversation as well about race, right? Because I think a lot of the ideas behind the coquette stuff that's really exclusive is not just about wealth and class, but it has a lot to do with race. And I think it's interesting because Nara is standing at this, like, cross-section.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about, like, what we talked about earlier about almost, like, these icons that we're associating with the coquette movement, like we were talking about Lolita, Lana Del Rey, whatever,
mm-hmm.
those are all white women as well. And so she's kind of inserting herself into this as well. And
mm-hmm.
so that's an interesting thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's cool because it's like we can see someone like her participating in it, but can black women and like average people who are not rich, like, participate
no.
in it if they're not like white? Like, I don't know. I feel like it is extremely like inaccessible, because there's one thing, you know, like wearing a little pink bow on your head is very different than like waking up at 8 a.m. to make sourdough and like film videos and
mm-hmm.
like be rich and not have to care about like how much money you make. Like, I just don't think that this is an aesthetic that everyone can like fully participate in, and maybe not an aesthetic, but like a lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's trying to sell you a lifestyle.
And I think it's like you have to acknowledge the historical aspects of that, right? Like the idea that white feminism even had this sort of dilemma of whether they're going to be girl bosses or they're going to be housewives, or they're going to work outside the home or inside the home. That idea is so with it, like embedded in whiteness and white feminism and how white feminism has progressed with second wave, third wave stuff. Whereas black women have always been working inside and outside of the home out of necessity, right? Whether that being outside the home in someone else's home, doing all of that kind of emotional domestic labor for another white person's family. For black women, this coquette stuff is not just like, you know, an aesthetic they can choose to be part of or not. And it has a lot to do also with femininity and how we access femininity. So the idea is that every like coquette icon we're thinking of right now mm-hmm. is a white woman with a bow mm-hmm. is not something that Black women can access, even if you're simplifying it to like how they've been hypersexualized in history, how they are seen now. You know, these are real people who historically have been oppressed, who today cannot access these sort of norms. And I think it's interesting to talk about Nara Smith as this individual, like, Black woman who is so tied to whiteness, and that mm-hmm. she's Mormon, she's married Lucky Blue Smith, of all people, yeah. right? And she's, you know, this, almost becoming this American icon mm-hmm. when she is German, first of all. I don't yes. know if you guys know that, but yeah, she's German. Yes. And it's just so, like, it's so interesting because it's not the African-American woman who is struggling to make ends meet who we need to be talking about in this general idea of femininity and who is accessing it. It's this, like, specifically situated person who has brought on this conversation of coquetteness. And
I mean, I would just ask at that point, like, how much is Nara Smith representative of other people? What I'm sensing is that she's not. So how does she come into this conversation when we're talking about trends of what people are embracing? Why is she relevant to this conversation?
When we were just talking about her, the word that comes to mind is, like, she's an exception. She's not a representation of, like, the average, like African-American, like, Black woman. And the reason she's in the position she is right now is specifically because of social media and privilege and being able to sit at home, make content, and being a pretty famous model, married to a famous model, and, like, you just have all this time that you can dedicate to create this very unique kind of content that people are just absolutely going to eat up. Like, they love it.
She's an exception, but she's also within the, like, she's one of many white women who will do this. She's an exception because she's not white. Mm-hmm. That's basically the delineation, I would say.
Well, it kind of ties back to this whole idea that we were talking about these young girls consuming this content. It's like, that is a lot of her audience, and that's what's almost like propelling her and has blown her up, is that these young girls are consuming this and, like, loving it and, like, wanting to be this in a way. And also, yeah, she's a model, and body image is a huge part of this also. So when you think about young teens, tweens, whatever, you know, they want to aspire to have that body, have that family, those kids and whatever. So,
and I think this is really tying together how there are cross effects on both sides, right? So this is how it's affecting maybe millennial or young adult women, the, you know, infamousness of Nara Smith and also the many other influencers who are like her. But the fact that her audience is so young means that we have girls who are skipping over girlhood, trying to jump into womanhood, which has historically been a trend, but it's happening in different ways now. But they're also not dreaming of becoming, maybe girl boss isn't ideal, but, you know, when I was growing up, it was like, we're looking at mystery novels, or I want to be like an investigator, or I want to be a journalist, or I want to do whatever else it might be. Like, the dreams that we were feeding young girls, which, you know, have their flaws as well, but the dreams we were feeding them were not to be Nara Smith, the gorgeous model housewife who's making bread, you know, like, so that is sure to have long-term effects.
Yeah, I also think that it's interesting that we grew up in this girl boss era, mm-hmm. so we were being fed that. And I think almost it's like a whole, again, the pendulum swing, where it's like, it's almost like that is a privileged piece of, like, information that we had. Is it's like that whole girl boss thing is like a given. Like, yes, women can do something like that. And so I guess people are, like, almost doing the opposite now. And, like, maybe that's affecting girls negatively. And maybe they will grow up not knowing the same sort of things that we know about aspiring to be, you know, women.
I think that's a really good segue when we talk about the pendulum switching and swinging maybe more towards the right. I don't know mm-hmm. if that's something that people have noticed in their day-to-day lives. I definitely notice it a lot on social media, specifically on, like, TikTok, with a lot of, like, ideological polarization. And I think that's why we see a resurgence in, like, the cottagecore movements and, like, this return, like, back to the home, with women being like, is it really liberating to go work a 9-to-5? Because it doesn't feel like mm-hmm. it. And, like, they're not wrong. But you're not going to be liberated if you have to stay home and be dependent on the income of a man. Like, that's just the reality of it. But we have influencers like this who are selling this dream. And it results in people in grade 6 and 7, when they're asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they answer YouTuber or influencer.
And I think tied to that, there's so much to say as well about cost of living and, you know, the economic just situation for everyone now, where it doesn't feel, yeah, it doesn't feel liberating to be working so hard or to be a corporate slave. There's a lot of like important discussions to be had about how obviously women under capitalism are not going to achieve like immense liberation or freedom. But at the same time, right, there's like a lack of critically thinking about what the opposite alternative might be. And I think a lot of the time there's this like collective memory loss or like amnesia about, you know, like, well, what we had before this was not actually this like utopian society, right? And it's even interesting, this is maybe a bit of a side offshoot, but I even think about movies like Don't Worry Darling, mm-hmm. where there's like, it's supposed to be futuristic, like this is meant to be post societal, like this is a, you know, specific program where they're putting you in an alternate universe, whatever, and the ideals that people have for what will happen in the future is a return to a 1950s sort of, you know, model of the home. And it's like, one, you know, there's maybe something to be said about a lack of imagination and creativity there, but I think more importantly there's this discussion of, I think it's really hard to imagine an alternate universe where women and men are actually equal. So when we get frustrated and run into these economic recessions or these problems on our day-to-day lives where we're like, women are making money, there is dual income in the home, and it's not working, it's not enough, people mm-hmm. still can't buy a home, people still can't afford like basic things, so like what is the alternative that we've seen before? And so that is sort of the resurgence that I think maybe that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to bring up sort of like this conservative backlash that we're in right now, because if you think about historically in specifically the US, but in the 60s, when there was like an atmosphere of protest, mm-hmm. there was a conservative backlash to that revolved around this breadwinner ideology, where, you know, traditional values and a breadwinner being like the head of the family, and then the wife being domesticated and the kids, and the, you know, the father providing for the kids, was very much like the ideological backlash to, you know, civil rights movement, gay liberation movement, women's rights movement, and so many of those moments. And I think that, like, you know, to say, like, history repeats itself, and I think this is a similar thing where it's like on social media, women portraying themselves as this almost domesticated like figure is, you know, emblematic of this sort of shift.
But in when that backlash happened in the latter half of the 20th century, I feel like that came a lot more from like clearly from conservative circles, like politically mostly men who are pushing these kind of ideologies, when now this conversation that we're having is much more centered on the role of women. So is this something that women are embracing now, this kind of pendulum swing to the right, or is this being pushed on them from somewhere on the outside?
Well, I think a big part of it is also the discussion we had about women are, we assume a certain amount of agency and autonomy for women, right? So when we look at coquette trends and who's engaging in it, it looks like women. It looks like women are choosing that for themselves. But like, what are we doing that is actually free choice? Like, so in terms of that, right? Like, why are we still appealing to wanting to be girls? Why is there holding on to innocence? Like, you can't think about those things abstract from the historical context of why there's an obsession with women being innocent or like these ideals and figures that we still hold on to. So it might be women choosing to engage in it out of a frustration with girl bossery or whatever else it might be, but it's still coming from other influences that are not, you know, our own or, you know, absent from patriarchy and what exists around us, right?
I will also say that I do think that women are participating in it. And I think that with the pendulum, like, shift, we see feminism changing differently as well, where you have this push that's like women choosing equals good. What, no matter what women choose to do, that like that is representative of feminism. And I think I see it a lot in like, it's a justification for women and even younger people maybe sexualizing themselves as well, where it's like, well, it's a choice. Like, I can choose like what I want to look like. I can choose like what I want to dress like. But there's no critical analysis of, you know, what are the repercussions of, you know, not thinking critically about your choices and what they represent.
Yeah, I think it also just is another example, like choice feminism, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea that we can't be judgmental of other women's choices because they are their own, and women are always going to let each other down if we're going to be judgmental of people's choices. And therefore, the choice to be a housewife or a mother is equally legitimate as being, you know, a girl boss, which I think that's true to an extent. Of course, like anyone can choose whatever life they want for themselves. But I think that it also lacks nuance to blanketly say that we can't judge women's choices. Because at the same time, sometimes women's choices harm other women, and they reinforce patriarchy, and they reinforce bad gender roles. And those are things that people should be allowed to be critical of without being called this sort of, like, anti-feminist sort of, you know, rhetoric that's being thrown around. And so I think that's a big part of it as well. But I wanted to ask what you guys thought as well in terms of something I said earlier about what, like, what we're doing as not really choice in terms of how it relates to women being obsessed with being younger, these, like, fear of aging, and younger girls always wanting to be older, maybe as a way to access freedom or liberation, and just what that dynamic looks like with maybe the mother-daughter relationship.
I think we can definitely talk about the Sephora tweens, because I've witnessed it in person, I've seen it online, and for anyone who's not familiar with it, there's been this really popular trend happening over the past few months where girls, I would say between the ages of like maybe 9 to 13, have been going to Sephora, wrecking some of like the skincare and makeup displays. There's been a few very popular brands. I'll call out Drunk Elephant, Glow Recipe, maybe like Summer Fridays. And these are brands that have very like colorful marketing that are almost like very fun to play with. And it's very attractive, I think, for like a 10 to 12 year old girl. But we're seeing it specifically in skincare and makeup, where these young girls are buying and using products that are specifically designed for anti-aging, or like very strong, like chemical exfoliants and retinols that are literally targeted towards aging women, or honestly just anyone who's above the age of like 25. And it's really concerning. Like, I've never seen it. I mean, we grew up going to Claire's and playing with, you know, like cell phone lip gloss. And now we have girls begging their moms to buy an $89 anti-aging overnight serum.
And I think it's so interesting the way you talked about Drunk Elephant marketing and colorfulness and how that plays into it. Because I remember we had this discussion and Charlotte and I walked into Sephora that day, and there was a massive display for Drunk Elephant that looked like legitimately a playground. Like, it was all like neon pink, neon green, neon orange, and it was like swirls and all this. And like, what is going on? If you're creating anti-aging products, and I think where it comes from is this like moving away of skincare can be fun, right, for women. Instead of it being like Estee Lauder or, you know, these like kind of big name brands that have lasted the test of time, you associate with like your mother or your grandmother, like, you know, those types of things are not attractive to middle or younger women. And so the marketing is meant to make it feel fun and playful, but then it backfires because tweens are like, well, this is for me, right? And I can't blame them. I mean, a lot of it comes back to the return to girlhood and making us feel like we want to be young girls who are having fun, but the girls are trying to have fun with like retinols and are burning their skin off.
I'm just wondering, like, this to me again feels like younger girls are imitating the way older people are acting because they have more access to the way to see how they are acting. Is the responsibility here for this happening on perhaps older generations not looking out for how what they're doing is influencing the younger generations? Is it again perhaps the companies that are doing marketing in a way that it makes it so active for younger girls? I'm just curious of like, where can we try to achieve changes, perhaps, if this is not a desirable phenomenon? Who should we target to achieve those changes?
Like, I think parents, like, like, there's always been bad influences all the time, especially geared towards girls and that tween age group, because we're just so impressionable and so easy to like force to overconsume or force our parents to let us overconsume. So like, parents maybe should be dealing with that. Like, I think it seems like such an obvious response, but even with social media, like, why are you giving your fourth grader a cell phone? What do they need that for? They're getting picked up at school. They're getting dropped off. You know, all of those really basic things I think we can return to with that. Or even the idea that, well, okay, to give parents a little bit of slack, I think part of it comes back to this economic, like, panic that is happening, where it's so hard to just feel like you can engage in consumerism anymore. And with makeup, and this is, I feel, always been true for women, it's really easy to consume like one small product as a way to be like, this is my like capital liberation today. Like, I can buy this lipstick and I feel okay about myself. And I think it bleeds into parents, where it's like, I can accommodate or I can appease my daughter who is screaming, crying, throwing up over this lip balm that's $30. And, you know, that'll be what I'm providing them today. And that's, I think, part of it, I think, with parenting.
Yeah, I also, I wonder about how schools can play into this as well. because I remember being, you know, in middle school and having a police officer come into our assembly and give us a chat about like online safety and, you know, trying to scare us a little bit, being like, you know, don't do anything weird on social media, basically. But it's just so much has progressed since then. Like the conversation that we were having when we were in middle school about social media use is just, I almost would think irrelevant now. Just because it's like, it's not just about safety, you know. Back in the day, it was like, don't go and chat on Omegle with like people, you know what I mean? But now it's like, okay, let's talk about how this is affecting your day-to-day lifestyle. Let's talk about your mental health and whatever other things that like having a phone at such a young age is going to impact.
Rotting your brain.
Yeah, actually, like maybe like, I don't know, when I was that age, it was like, what about reading, guys? Like, whatever happened to reading?
Yeah, I think parents are incredibly disconnected from how, I guess, intense technology is now. Like, I don't think they understand what is even on their children's algorithm if they have access to social media. And I really like your comment about lipstick as, like, a recession indicator. And it's so true. Like, that's why people are participating in it. Like, everyone's broke. Kids now have access to so many trends and so many popular things. They just want their little summer Friday vanilla lip balm. And it's like, yeah, I don't blame them. And I also don't think we can really blame influencers who are influencing all these young girls, because I mean, for a lot of people, that's like their job, and they don't, I don't want to say they don't care who is consuming their content, but like, they're making money. They can't really be held fully responsible for young girls having access to all these new ideas and things that they want to buy.
I was gonna add on to this idea of like millennials becoming parents and just making their kids iPad babies, and it's like, it comes from Claire's question of like, whatever happened to reading? Like, I think even going to just restaurants and like brunch time, and again, it's like, yes, these millennial parents are the girl bosses that we're talking about, right? Like, they're so tired, they have so much work to do, they're trying to make it all happen, they're trying to still have kids, which apparently is now this like thing that you have to do because the population is declining separately. But I feel like this iPad baby phenomenon is what is bleeding into this Gen Alpha TikTok thing, right? Like, they grew up with, I don't even know what's on their iPads or like what would be relevant today, but they're not reading.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting to think about millennials becoming parents, because they grew up with the internet and they grew up online. And I think because of that, they potentially can almost feel like they're knowledgeable, that they understand what's going on and they understand how, or they might think they know what's right for their kids because they also grew up with the internet, versus, for example, our parents who did not grow up with the internet. And so I think it's interesting to think about how they're then parenting their children. And similar to that, it's like, once you give the kid the iPad once, you know, and it works, it's like, okay, I'm tired.
It's a pacifier.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a pacifier, literally.
Yeah, I like the point that you made about like how like they have the sense that they know what they're doing, but the internet today is not the internet that they grew up with. I think that's a really important thing that we see, like, in general, like, a lot of millennials, like, for example, for me, in my work, I work with a lot of millennials, we work in communications, they still think they know how social media works from back in time when they used to be on social media as much as we are, and like, they have no idea how TikTok works, they have no idea how the Facebook algorithm has changed, they have, you know, all of these things. So I think there's a lot of this is just like, the sense that you know what you're doing, but you actually don't.
Yeah. And to add on to that, I mean, my brother, I think, is always is the closest millennial around for me. And what I always think is, like, he grew up on MSN. Like, and I even fear, like, what will happen with us when we become older or become, like, parents, right? Like, our biggest fear was maybe, like, Ask FM.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, the idea that people are going to anonymously bully you. Like, that's, of course, bad. But it's nowhere near what's happening with kids now who are getting, you know, horribly bullied on TikTok. And not just that, but it's not people interacting with them. It's like the algorithm ruining their lives. So you can't fight the algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. The more content you're consuming that maybe is perpetuating like body dysmorphia or eating disorder content, like that re-perpetuates itself. It's not just people being mean to you on like a human level. It's like the algorithm is actively making your life worse. And once you're in it, of course, especially with how young these kids are, your brain wants that, like, it chemically wants to stay on TikTok. It wants to stay consuming that media. And so, yeah, it's just a terrifying situation, I honestly think, for the Sephora tweens.
Okay. I also think that it's interesting because when we were young and we were on social media, I never felt like what I was consuming on social media was then how I needed to behave in real life. So what I was seeing, I mean, I don't even think we were looking at influencers back then. But, like, for example, if I was on YouTube, for example, I wasn't like, oh, I need to get this skincare item or this shirt, whatever. It was more in my immediate circle, a group of friends. Like, oh, my friend just got the new Aviva leggings. I want to get those, too. But I think that it all ties back to this, like, teens wanting to be older is because they're just wanting to consume what they're being sold, like literally sold, especially since a lot of these like Instagram, like reels or whatever, are actual ads.
And I think we can actually link this to the pandemic in a way that like we were able to learn from our friends in middle school what the trends were because we were in middle school with our friends. But now if the only people you socially interact with are influencers on TikTok because you're at home for 3 years or two, then you start shifting where you get your influences from. And I think that's where, like, you know, your classmates are not going to be 10 years older than you, but the people you're watching on TikTok are likely to be. So I wonder if, like, that's playing a role here. Friends are being replaced by TikTok influencers.
I think also it comes back to the idea that social media just kept changing, right? Like, social media originally was meant to help people connect. And it's now, I think, predominantly a marketing tool that is bought out by, you know, big corporations. So instead of being on Instagram because you're curious what Selena Gomez was doing with Justin Bieber that day, which is like hilarious, it has nothing to do with your life, but it's not something you're trying to emulate. It's you're going on Instagram or TikTok and it's all ads and it's stuff. And it's even if it's not an ad, it's a person selling you something. And so the way you're interacting with social media is entirely about what can I consume next? And so when you're a child, it means like, what can I force my mom to buy me next? But when you're a woman or you're someone with, you know, any kind of disposable income, it is that effect of what can I consume next to, like, literally feel something.
Yeah, and I think that a part of this whole consumer culture and Coquette is the Stanley. And I think that, like, that is honestly the staple of a lot of this movement is, like, what was the biggest Christmas item that 10-year-olds wanted this year? It was the Stanley. But, you know, if you think about it, like, even like 2 years ago, I would say, Emma Chamberlain had a Stanley like 2 years ago. And that's something that I noticed. And then it trickled down so fast and it became a staple of this whole aesthetic and culture.
I saw the funniest TikTok that was like, what were the water bottles we were carrying in middle school looking like? And it was like, obviously the Costco, like plastic, probably giving you some microplastics in your water type thing that your mom would fit in your lunchbox. Like, there was no idea of around like having the coolest. I think it maybe started in grade 8 with Swell bottles and the idea that you wanted to be like have an aesthetic water bottle on your desk. But again, like that's not happening till you have somewhat of a brain. Like you're like a teenager, you're entering high school, you're carrying it maybe like in your hand or on your backpack. I don't know. It's not your mom is packing your lunchbox and adding a Stanley.
Yeah, I feel like you went from like Swell to Hydro Flask and now it's Stanley, but there was never pressure to collect different colors. And like these bottles aren't cheap. So it's one thing to, you know, if you're 12 years old, you're collecting those mini hand sanitizers from Bath & Body Works. That's, I feel like, super normal. That makes sense. But to like pressure your parents to buy what they're like 60, 70 bucks, like these massive bottles, but it's also like, then if we, that also bleeds into the Coquette aesthetic because people are like wanting to like customize it to like look like this like pretty soft pink ballet core with like ribbons. And like that is, I feel like, emblematic of the way that that aesthetic bleeds into your lifestyle. And they'll run out to Target to go get like the red and pink one and even laminate the tumbler Stanley like wrapping on it because it's so like limited edition.
Though I wonder how much that's like younger girls or younger kids wanting to like get these more adult products, or how much it is like millennials trying to push a different aesthetic on their kids. And what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make here is that like millennials were the first generation to like grow up with a lot of color photos available of them, and there's this whole thing of like, look how my mom used to dress me when I was 5 years old, here's this ugly photo of me in a bright pink suit or something in the 80s or 90s. And like, and a lot of these people were then like, well, I'm going to make sure that my kid looks put together. And so how much is this like, I wonder if this phenomenon is also to some extent millennials wanting to care about what their kids look like. not just the kids wanting to look like adults, but it's like millennials don't want the kids to feel about them the same way they felt about their parents, that they look ugly when they were kids.
I feel like definitely for younger kids, and by younger kids I mean like even your 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, like I used to work as a lifeguard at a pool, and they used to bring around like a lot of really young kids, and it was in Toronto and a bit more of like the Trinity Bellwoods area, which is a bit more trendy, I guess you could say, but they would dress their kids in like what I could only compare to like how Kim Kardashian would dress her kids in bathing suits, yeah. Like this like really, really nice matching aesthetics, to the point where we were all sitting around being like, whatever happened to your Joe Fresh, like, bathing suit? You know what I mean? Like, I think there is, like, a very conscious wanting to make your kids cool.
I think it's interesting, too, because I can't imagine any of our parents thinking, I want my kid to be dressed a certain aesthetic. Like, yeah. I think aesthetics and just the idea that we're not even just consuming, like, things, but ideas and vision boards of what we're supposed to want is a very new social media driven thing. And it's like with millennials wanting their kids to be in the matching suit, I feel like it was maybe one or two fashionista parent who might do that to their kid in like the 90s or 80s. But now it's like everyone is consuming all of this stuff all the time. And you can't be the one like leaving your kid at preschool wearing the ugliest outfit ever,
yeah.
Right? Because then you're like failing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pressures of for everyone to match ideals of what they're consuming to be supposedly cool or supposedly trendy is just so different now.
I also think this is kind of like paradoxical, but I also think certain people find it trendy to like not participate in trends, and I think that that's also a bigger reflection of like nothing you do is really like a free choice, because it's either you're participating and you're trying to like match aesthetics, or you think you're different and it's like pick me and you're so cool and
yeah.
You're like this crunchy granola like millennial family that's trying to like disconnect your kid from the world, but then you're like making money off of that and posting your kid on social media showing how they're like not like falling for the big trends.
And just the duality of that too, like you're like a lot of these people are like so crunchy granola, but then everything is like bamboo, undyed, no painting, like so everything's this like beige undertone color, and your kid is going to preschool wearing like beige and brown tones as their outfit. Like no child is choosing that as the colors that are attractive to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the choices that your parents are making for you to be healthier or different or not matching aesthetics is also in turn a different set of aesthetics that they're choosing.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, like, how are these kids gonna turn out? So, like,
yes.
To put it in a bit of a blunt way, like, how is all this gonna affect them in the future, especially the younger kids, elementary age
mm-hmm.
and middle school age?
Well, I always wonder about, like, what will happen to the Sephora tweens, because I think the closest equivalent of a bad influence for us when we were tweens, and I think fewer people engaged in it than Sephora tweens now, is Tumblr.
Yeah.
And Tumblr
yeah.
still has lasting effects, I think, on us today. Like, people will still reference, like, oh, yeah, like, back in the Tumblr days, like, the eating disorder kind of, like,
mm-hmm.
content or, like, inspiration. Like, it's crazy, right? Like, these ideas that what affected you in your formative years are going to be carried with you forever. I don't know what will happen to Sephora tweens, because I think we're already in this skincare anti-aging craze. Then you add in Ozempic and you add in all these other like terrifying sort of things that young women are already feeling the pressure to aspire to. So what happens when you started that when you're 11? And I don't think that there's an equivalent pendulum swift out of it, right? Like once you've been in it, how do you get out of it?
Well, I think bringing up Tumblr is a really interesting example, because I think that was a big staple of us, like us 20-year-olds, if you think back to it, our social media days, that was a huge thing. But I think a lot of people talk about it in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think anyone's really thinking back, like, the Tumblr days, those were great. Like, I think people are thinking about it and like, wow, that was a time when we were all like taken on a ride that was that was negative, and it was unregulated, and it was, you know, a lot of toxic and harmful content that like to some actually had lasting mental issues. Like,
yeah.
I would say like some people's mental health issues could be rooted in what they were consuming on Tumblr, and like that it, when you're growing up in middle school, has a really big effect on like who you
yeah.
become.
I want to go off what you mentioned about like how's the pendulum gonna swing back, and for me, that like brings me to this whole topic from a very different perspective. Like, is the pendulum actually swinging for people, or is it just swinging across time with generations as a certain generations are getting older? So there's no pendulum swinging back for the people who are born like between the 90s and the 2000s. It's more that the people in their 20s now are people born in the later 2000s. And so I feel like maybe we're just observing this from the outside. As like, well, people in their 20s are dressing more conservatively than people used to dress in their 20s, but because the people that used to be in their 20s are in their 30s now. And so maybe this is not as big of a phenomenon as what I'm trying to get at. It's just like generations and time passing.
So I would say no, in that I think there are two like parallel things going on. One of them is probably generational, where we're talking about things aging out and things being like not cool anymore, or people growing up with different sets of technology and around them. So that generational thing is definitely happening in a non-pendulum swinging kind of way. But in terms of the conservatism we were talking about earlier, I do think that that is very pendulum-y, for lack of a better word. I think there's this idea of like the girl bossery and like women being out of the home, that's an ideal. And like that is like our idea of progressiveness. And then that becomes frustrating and, you know, it runs its course. And the pendulum needs to swing somewhere else, right? Like, they need to tell us to be a different thing. And so the frustration with the corporate slave mentality of girl bossery kind of shifted it. I think there were, like, some medium points where maybe the pendulum could have stopped and it didn't, where it was like, okay, well, it's okay to be a woman who's doing both, or, like, it's important for us to do both. Or, and then on top of that, there was this reaction of, but with the girl boss kind of era and narrative, you are excluding women who choose not to do that. And I think that became a really popular idea of, well, if we need to be accepting of everyone, then we need to give people who choose not to be girl bosses their own platform. And as the pendulum of frustration kept swinging towards conservatism, that sort of is now like blown up. And I think that pendulum will continue to swing, to be honest. But I think as it pertains to kids and what they're influenced by, I'm interested to see what will happen when they reach our age group and, you know, maybe go to college and like hopefully like find a little bit of critical thought and like figure out what happened to them. And hopefully they can look back at the way we look back at Tumblr, they can look back at themselves at 12 years old on TikTok and be like, that was really depressing. And I hope that doesn't happen anymore. But I don't know what goes beyond that, right? Like, I don't know what their equivalent of coquette, but like opposite for them will look like.
I will say, I do think people our age, when we become parents, we are going to, like, a lot of people will fully disconnect from social media and especially trends, because I think a lot of people by that point will be exhausted and won't have money to keep up. And then we're going to view this time as like, wow, that was a crazy ride every 6 weeks, like being like, you know, pushed to like buy something new or like have this new capsule wardrobe aesthetic where it's like, it's not possible. And I think we're going to think really critically about the effects of social media on us and how we got I feel like the first pretty bad wave with like phone addiction and anything from like toxic views on like body, mental health, you name it. So I think that we're not going to want our kids to have as much tech as maybe millennials do for their iPad kid babies. But like you said, it's a pendulum. So I think we will probably start retracting a bit, but it'll just depend.
I think a quick note on that too is right before this hyper-consumerist vibe that I would say we're in now, it was the millennial capsule wardrobe. You can fit everything you want in your carry-on suitcase and you're going to travel the world. And like, that was such an aesthetic that people strive towards, which is equally unattainable, obviously. But I think it comes back to, like, are we going to swing back to that? Because, like, and if that's the trend with the pendulum swinging within fashion, what does that look like for every other aspect of lifestyle and the choices that we're interacting with every day, right? Because I think the hyper-consumerism right now is definitely not sustainable, and I don't know what will happen after.
I think also it's interesting that we are reflecting on this and criticizing almost the people that are slightly older than us and the people that are slightly younger than us. To be honest, like, I think that even speaking with people, a lot of people our age, it's like criticizing that and also thinking about how we're going to differentiate ourselves. And so I wonder if they like will come to a point where they grow up and also do a similar thing where they're kind of criticizing what's going on as well. Because I think that, like you said, like when I think about how I want to be a parent, it's like I don't want this at all for my kids. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that both of these things, like the millennial parent and the millennial child, I guess you could say, is something that I really don't want for, like, my family, per mm-hmm. se, but...
Well, maybe a fun, maybe not that lighthearted, but kind of lighthearted way to wrap up would be, I'm just thinking of the question, because I think it's totally true. We've been spending this podcast kind of criticizing those older and younger. What do we think will be the criticism of us mm-hmm. when, let's say, the Sephora tween Gen Alpha kids are in college? What will be said of Gen Z? I'm so curious. My intuition is going to be something along the lines of, like, these crazy hyper-consumerist
yes.
kind of...
It's almost like, how did we let it get this bad? How did we, how was there not like almost like a mass movement to just be like, okay, delete all your social media. Like, this is out of hand. Like, we can't keep up with these trends. We can't keep up with like these aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And like, we all just let it happen. And we always romanticize it. Like, it's anything from like a Halloween party to like Euphoria Sundays or like whatever, like any kind of pop culture, like mass trends and like mm-hmm. almost popular sayings, even our like TikTok lingo, mm-hmm. which is so embarrassing, but it's literally a part of like every single one of us. I think they're gonna look at us and like cringe very, very hard.
Yeah, I also think that this is a critique that Gen Z is kind of already getting, but just a self-centeredness, mm-hmm. An idea that like we are the center of everything. Like the fact that we even think that people will care enough about our generation
yeah.
to talk about it, or like the fact that we think that like we have to change a lot of social issues as well. It's like, this is a multi-generational, you know, world that we all have power in and stuff like that. But I think that, I don't know, I think that, yeah, self-centeredness is something that I've heard critiques about.
That is such an interesting one, too, because I think that the people say that about every generation when they're in this 20-year-old
mm-hmm.
range, right?
Yes.
Because 20-year-olds are inherently going to be the most self-centered. Like, we have agency,
yes.
we have
mm-hmm.
a little bit of autonomy and money,
yeah.
but we don't have, like, any life experience or, like, true...
Or responsibility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's such an interesting one, because Gen Z gets so much flack for a lot of things, but I think
mm-hmm.
it's true of, like,
every
yeah. generation in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Tao, what do you think?
I mean, my final thoughts is going to depend on, like, and this is maybe to bring it to a boring close, but like how the economic situation is going to
yeah.
carry on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very difficult for us to predict like what limitations are we going to face when we're going to be the generation of parents. And so I really struggle to think of like, well, I need to extrapolate twice to get to the conclusion of like, well,
mm-hmm.
what are these younger people are going to criticize us about when we have no idea. The world is changing so fast. The economic
mm-hmm.
situation is changing so fast and acting unpredictably. I think it's really hard to like point out like, this is how we're going to be a parent and this is what people are going to be pointing out about us.
Yeah.
But in any case, I'm very curious to hear what future generations are going to be saying about our parenting as Gen Z, and maybe in the future we're going to be able to listen to another podcast such as this one, and we're going to hear the million things that we are doing wrong as parents, but also hopefully what we're doing right. And with that, we come to the end of this episode. Thank you very much, Claire and Char, for joining the Editor's Desk, and for our listeners, we'll see you in the next episode of our podcast.